Thank you very much for having me back. It may be deja vu for some of you. I was here exactly a year ago talking about this. I was here 2 years ago when we all laughed about how it wasn't going to happen. Brexit really is a gift that keeps on giving. It is the most interesting thing I think has happened for years. My aim, by the way, is to try to be invited back and just to see how many times on May the 25th. We can keep on saying there's something completely new. There isn't a new book, and one reason there isn't a new book is because Brexit is so interesting and so complicated. It's a little bit like the Watts riots of 1965, where at the time people just said these are riots, they're terrible, rioters are evil. But 3 years after the riots, Martin Luther King said it's the voice of the unheard, and we looked at the riots a bit differently. You need a bit of time after a referendum, I think, to see what it tells us, what it's showing us about ourselves. We certainly didn't know ourselves, none of us. There wasn't a silent minority or majority who actually understood what the UK or the English wanted. Nobody understood about this country until at least we went through this. I showed this map last year, I'll show it again. It's a map of Europe, stretched by population, so you can see how important areas are. It's countries that drive it in, coloured by when they came in, or candidate countries, or countries on the edge of candidacy, like Turkey. The UK is significant, but not huge. The only other place to have left the European community is Greenland. They spent 3 years doing it, they had 56,000 people. They had fish. I'll get on to that about affording. Affording is the key question. The Governor of the Bank of England raised it again in the last 2 days. Because in a way, this is when we find out just how well off we are. We can all talk about whether we're a rich country or not a rich country who can afford things, and we can never agree on that. The nice thing about Brexit is it's a great test as to what we can actually afford to do. I think we can afford to have no MEPs for a bit. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing for us not to have MEPs. I don't think we've behaved particularly well in Europe. I don't like Nigel Farage having a job, personally. But we can afford to have no MEPs. We can afford to pay our fair share of the dues of what we signed up for. It's a bit like war debt. You simply agree how many decades or centuries we're going to pay it back over. But we can certainly afford to pay back however many in billion euros we're committed to because we agreed jointly to the various things then. So we can afford that. The question is, what else can we actually afford to do? Can we afford to actually bang a hard border through Ireland if we decide to be bloody minded? Or will we find out that we can't afford to do that? I'll give you one example of affording. Recently, the British government claimed that we were the second biggest arms trader in the world. And if you're like me, it's a bit embarrassing to be the second biggest arms trader in the world. But I, at a talk, pointed this out, said the first biggest arms trader is the USA, the second biggest is the UK, the country that wins the most Olympic medals is the USA, the second most Olympic medals is the UK, the fattest people in the world are the USA, the second fattest are the UK. And I collect together these one and two things for the UK and the USA. A civil servant from the Department of Defence emailed me and said, we're not the second biggest arms trader in the world, we're actually the sixth. And if you look at the data from Sweden on arms sales, we are the sixth. But our government wants us to be the second biggest. That's the kind of tragic state we're in. We want to be able to claim that we're doing something very bad, selling actually more arms than we really are. I must move on. So looking back in hindsight, this is, well, it's labelled productivity, but it's exactly the same almost as GDP trends. And you can see 2008, things kind of hit a brick wall. And looking back at the 2016 referendum, you've got to put it in the context of the shock of 2008. In 2008, there was a kind of jubilant atmosphere. It wasn't great. We had become the most unequal country in Europe, but we didn't know we were. Nobody had actually published that figure. But more importantly, we were celebrating our wonderful bankers. If you remember 2006, 2007, bankers were buying bottles of champagne for £30,000, with a diamond in worth £10,000. That's still £20,000 down the drain in 20 minutes. And we said this was a jolly good thing because they're making so much money for Britain. Those lines going up all the forecasts which don't ever come true. This is the kind of scary thing. So the question is, if we enact Empire 2.0, will that line zoom off? Or won't it? That's the kind of gamble as we head towards maybe some kind of agreement next month, and let's face it, there isn't going to be one. Supposedly, an agreement in October, that's when we're supposed to come to an agreement with our former 27 friends, but we can't anyway. The map. The map is remarkable. I showed this again last year. There is no other map of human geography in Britain like this map. Right? The map of the voting is really, really interesting. I'm not going to go into it in great deal because you know a lot of it by heart now, but I'm just going to show you some things you may not be aware of. Very early on, I think this was Alistair Ray in very early July 2016, plotted deprivation versus the vote and found a correlation of 0.03. Deprivation versus the vote 0.03, no correlation. It was not the poor, it was not the working class, it was not Stoke, it was not Middlesbrough, it was not Great Yarmouth. It's a correlation of 0.03. I'm hoping that within 3 or 4 years from now, I'm going to have to be able to stop saying that. We wanted it to be, by we I mean white, middle class, Oxford educated, or I went to school in Oxford at least. Oxford. So me and Jeffrey Archer both claiming things we can't. But we wanted so desperately to blame the uneducated and the weak. But it isn't, in any other way. This is still disputed, this graph here. So, the people who most voted for Remain were the young? No, they were not the young. People who voted most for Remain were aged 35 to 44. I can now call them young, I'm 50. I'm enjoying getting old. But 35 to 44 year olds, that was the key Remainers. The young were in bed. That's a little always army bed. Hopefully you're another member of the young. Now these are disputed, but honestly you can work out the turnout figures. We know the overall turnout, they've got to add up. Okay? So yes, as people get older they're more likely to go to leave. And the work I'm involved with my colleague Sally Thomason will hopefully finally result in the book next year, maybe on the point we leave, is looking at why do people of different ages vote that way? Why that curve of the black line? And we're looking at the curriculum. What were you taught at school about the country? How great were you taught Great Britain or England was? Can that correlate with the age? That's the kind of thing I'm interested in. But what I wanted to do, point out there, is it isn't that the young were incredibly pro-European. They weren't key. This really complicated graph is produced by a young man called Daniel Watts, who's not a researcher in any university. But what Daniel did was line up all the constituencies of England into groups, 10 groups. The poorest 10th, number one most deprived, furthest away from me. The least deprived, number 10. And then coloured them by whether they were Remain, Strong Remain, Leave, Strong Leave. Posh areas, all Remain. Wherever a BBC executive lives, wherever a University of Oxford professor lives, wherever anybody you see on the telly, apart from the token poor people they put on, you know, the Victoria Derbyshire show, I'm being a bit flippant, but that's the country we live on. All the posh people live in at least the 5 areas and they vote Remain. Now forget that for a second and look at the other 90% of Britain. And you might have to squint, but it's the 4 middle columns that are most purple. It's Middle England that voted out most solidly. It wasn't the most deprived areas, there's actually more yellow in the more deprived areas, more Remain. It was the middle. It was, and I'm going to zoom on, it was poor Tories. They're not that poor, but people who voted Tory who are amongst the poorer people who vote Tory. It's very like Trump voters. Um, I'm going to have to be rude because of lack of stack of time. It's great to be. Loads of analyses came out. This was from a set of people. Wonderfully, the researchers are called Mario Cortina Borgia, Julian Stander, and Lucina Dallavella. And they were doing a study of how many people had unique names in each area and the Brexit vote. And the higher the proportion of people with unique names, the lower the vote leave, because it's a measure of immigration. The more immigrants you have, the more diverse your area, the happier you are with Europe. No immigrants, things are bad. You're voting Tory, but nothing seems to ever go right for you. You vote leave. In England, in Wales, but not in Scotland, in the middle. No relationship in Scotland. Fascinating thing. And now by far the rudest was done by Peter or Moses. It's still up there on the LSE blog. I don't know how much longer. He got in some trouble with the Daily Mail in his way. A combination of, I feel, given I'm a man of some stature, physically, I don't feel too bad saying this, but a combination of 0.8 between being overweight and voting to leave. Why? Partly because it's a very dodgy measure of weight. And I think Public Health England did some tricky stats where they used something actually correlated quite well with whatever predicts leave. But also, when you think about things like immigration, immigrants tend to be young and fit and thin. Areas with few immigrants, areas where things are going not too well, tend to be larger. Well-fed poor Tories. Stop that. Okay, we're coming to the time. If you can see that list comes from the Sunday Times Rich List, the latest one. These are the top 50 donors amongst the richest 1,000 people. You can look at the wide diversity of political parties that the richest people in Britain donate money to. That map is a map of the European outlying areas and territories, and you can spot the Treasure Islands where they have their money. A large amount of the vote was not about you lot, unless one of you happens to be a key financier who funded the Brexit campaign. It was very rich men, often growing up in colonies, who really wanted to keep our sovereignty because they do not want control over their wealth from the EU. We're learning more and more and more about that. Don't worry about what Cambridge Analytica did. Worry about what the man who paid for Cambridge Analytica wanted. Right, go back, follow the money back. What were the people who paid to get people to vote to leave actually after? I had to do this. This is the imports and exports. You all know, of course, that we import and export massively with Europe. This is the IMF figures. We've got imports on the far side from me. We import most from Germany, then the US and China, then Netherlands, France, Belgium, Italy, Norway, Spain. It's huge. Last year, we've increased our imports from Germany by $1 billion, US by $1 billion, China by $1 billion, the Netherlands by $5 billion, remarkably. Exports, okay, we do export to the US more than anywhere else, but that's dropping $2 billion, but then look, it's all the EU. I mean, I suspect I don't have to convince you about this, but this isn't a game you play if you're being sensible. If we could magically move this country somewhere else, geographically, this might make more sense, but it really doesn't. The other really important thing to notice is that those figures for imports are much bigger than the figures for exports. We're importing far more than we export. How would we do that? We're not the United States. The United States does it by getting into massive debt and having nuclear missiles. And it basically, if you're the biggest player in the world, you can keep on buying stuff from China and not paying for it. But only the US can do that. Why is there a difference between those two sets of numbers? How have we managed to buy all our fridges and things when we're not making stuff that's worth other people having? Because of our finance sector. That's the invisible. So that's the difference between those two. Well, how does our finance sector work and make money? Because it's passported to work in Europe. How stupid are the Europeans? Not very. Are they really going to let us take the piss and make money from them in the way we have been doing by charging a slice of it as we use our expert bank? I mean, but anyway, the nice thing is that come this time next year, May 25th, 2019, we're not going to be arguing about it anymore. We're going to know. That's where it's getting to. Lots of things are going wrong. This country's had the biggest crisis in health since 2012. It has had since the bombing of the Second World War. That graph far away from me is just the extra additional deaths that have occurred this year. It is unbelievably bad. We have the worst record of any country in Europe. Our life expectancy has plateaued, and it's only plateaued, not fallen, because we still get some healthy young European migrants coming. It's tragic. The thing nearer to me, which you can't see, I know, but I have to see it up, is our ranking in Europe on the neonatal mortality rates. This is dying in the first 2 days of life, mainly. 1990, we were the seventh best country in Europe. By 2015, we were the 19th, dropping down. At the bottom is Romania. That's 2015, the last 2 years, infant mortality has risen absolutely, unprecedented in Europe, 2 years in a row. Never happened before, except for 2 years during the Second World War. But Brexit wipes all that out, doesn't it? I mean, you could kill the firstborn, to be honest, and with Brexit hanging over us, we just don't notice. In my whole life of looking at social statistics, for over 30 years now, things have never been as bad as this in terms of the trends, what's happening to health, what's happening for housing costs, what's happening. But Brexit just is like throwing that dead cat on the table. And so people say, oh, it's bad, but we've got to worry about Brexit. Voting, or some positive things. Amazing things can happen with voting. This graph at the top is one which was tweeted by Mr. Fraser from The Spectator. It's the swing of the election last June. Quite incredible. Corbyn got the highest swing since 1945. You have to compare it to Miliband. At least Miliband got a tiny positive swing. But that Corbyn won is 9.6. Brown had negative. Blair was negative, negative. And then one big one, but not as big in 97. It wasn't about Blair. That was about over a decade of Tory rule and people voting against it. That's what happened in 97. So in June 2007, you get the biggest, fastest swing of the population since 1945, and it's actually bigger because the 1945 swing was a swing over 10 years since 35. The swirly graph is just looking at it in detail. I put it up there because if anybody recognises that graph and has seen it done before, please come and tell me at the bookshop later. So we're trying to work out whether this way of graphing. The pole is the height, and the how fast it's moving is how far left and right it is. And you're going to have to trust me on this. I've drawn 2,000 of these graphs for all the main parties for every election since we've had polling data, and we've never had that happen before. That incredible change in May and early June last year has never happened before. And it suddenly makes different things possible. Theresa May was completely correct to call the election. She was bullied into calling it. Her officials who said, nobody has ever lost from the position you're in. Nobody has ever lost. You'd be a complete fool when she called it. That had never happened before. And that wasn't just the amazing charisma of Jeremy Corbyn. Because bless him, you know, I like him in many ways. And after 180 public rallies, he's finally learned to talk in public. But that is not because he's the Messiah. The modern polls are down the bottom. I won't go on about that. If anybody's fascinated by these things, that graph is the segregation index of the Conservative voters in Britain. It's how clustered together are Conservative voters across the whole of the UK, includes Northern Ireland. And towards the end, when we got a May Foster government, we finally get a dip. Although I have no time for that. That lovely map, beautiful little map, is the local election results. All I just say is try and spot Barnet. It's not that obvious. All that important. That map's red. Local election results were a significant move ahead. Just a few more maps for you. That's the former British Empire in the strange circles. It's very hard actually finding every last little chunk of the world's biggest empire, but we think we've done it. India's a large one. I'm amazed it allowed Charles to become the next head. I think it actually shows that the Commonwealth isn't taken that seriously. But, you know, that is maybe should be more careful, but honestly, when you get to 50, the only time you've just got to say what you believe. There's our former empire. We don't make very much of much use for them anymore. We used to force them to buy our cotton, it's called Manchester. We now make a rather nifty kind of vacuum cleaner somewhere in the Far East. It used to be made in Wiltshire. But when they moved to jobs, there weren't many jobs and nobody noticed. Well, I won't try and be unpatriotic, but honestly. Marks and Spencer's, the Empire Pie, could have a future in that. And the strange map of the country cut up is Freddie Heineken's 1992 map. Freddie commissioned a couple of historians to work out how Europe could be divided in future. And he actually got Yugoslavia remarkably correct. You'll notice you've got a united Ireland there, you notice you've got an independent Scotland. The others are maybe more fanciful, but we should perhaps look at it a bit more carefully than the way we used to dismiss it. I particularly like having a region called Northumbria but making its capital York. That's almost maybe the hardest one to do. Okay, more serious to end. This is a picture of a young lad near the Elephant Castle looking at the poster that's being put up by some nice activists. Telling him not to fill in a school census because the government were threatening to use the nationality to work out who to round up and deport from records collected in schools. It's not good. The huge amount of the racism that has risen is not good. It reminds me of the racism I encountered in the 1970s for the National Front telling people to go back where they came from. It is qualitatively the same. It's just affecting far more people. Here's a fool. He is an absolute fool, and if we can't recognise that he's a fool, how polite are people from the mainland? Yeah. I suppose we learn to be polite about Donald, but they're being polite about Boris, and him being upset about getting a plane that's graded he can only use occasionally. I mean, we're in a quite remarkable situation. Suez does nothing on this, you know, which is the last major time we discovered we weren't as big as we thought we were. Plus, maps of people for you. Of course, this most affects the 3 million people in this country, well, those who haven't gone yet. And large numbers haven't come, by the way. It's already affected immigration. It affects them, it affects their children at school, asking their parents whether they'll be able to stay. But it also affects the 1 million British people who are elsewhere in the mainland. That's an idea where they are. And there will be a book. So the book about Britain doesn't come out until July. I think if you want good news to end on, we are at a peak of inequality. There's lots and lots of evidence for a peak of inequality. The high point for me, just to leave you with a happy thought, is that the final peak of inequality was when the highest paid man ever was forced to resign a few weeks ago, which was Mr. Martin Sorrell of WPP. And that, at the point when he's no longer received that money, maybe the equivalent of 1913, which is the last time that Britain was at a peak of inequality. After 1913, we had a war. And that war absolutely crystallised it because you had to raise money from the rich to pay for the war. And that's when the steady rise in inequality began and carried on and on for 70 years. Brexit is much, much better than a war. It'll cost the rich the most because the rich have got something to lose. The poor in Britain don't have anything to lose anymore. And so Brexit is likely to bring us together, but not in a way it's necessarily going to be that happy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Danny. I'm going to have to be a bit of a Brexiter for a bit, because you're not. And there'll be some people here, I'm sure, who take the other side. You're saying this thing is a disaster, it's not as bad as World War One, but other than that, it's pretty terrible. But there are people who are sympathetic to where you are on equality and on what's gone wrong with the economy, who nonetheless see Brexit as something of an opportunity. We know that Corbyn and John McDonnell have some interest in like being able to avoid European regulations so they can do state aid and that kind of thing, and like maybe nurture domestic industries a bit more. There's also people like Larry Elliott, who's a writer at The Guardian, who takes the view that we've been talking about rebalancing the economy so it's not just about house prices and credit cards and the rest of it, but back to manufacturing. And that Brexit, you know, if it brings about a house price crash, might be the opportunity to do that. Do you think there's anything in that kind of case for a progressive Brexit at all?
I can see the Lexit kind of group. Okay, quite. Very short answer. I mean, one interesting thing about them is the age. So there were very few in that group who are not older than me, and quite a lot were around in the original 73, 75 referendum time. Well, I think you can make a case for us not joining. Because in the early 70s, we were the second most equal country in Europe to Sweden. Mm. And you could say that this was a capitalist cabal in Europe. We're joining a nasty club of people. But at the point we've talked about leaving, we're the most unequal, we're the most regressive country. We're the country whose Conservative Party stopped being a Conservative Party and ganged up with the Polish Law and Justice Party. And I think Alternative for Deutschland was in the group. The European Union was actually a progressive force on us, if only because we'd become so strange. But that kind of Larry Elliott thing is hoping to go from the bottom of the class to the top. You know, you suddenly go from being the country that's most calling for market forces, deregulation, allow whatever to happen, to maximum state intervention. And I think it's unlikely. Other European countries are very good at state intervention despite the rules. There are lots of ways of doing it. It's partly because we had an empire that we think walls really matter, but there are ways around. But my point of view, I voted Remain and I campaigned for Remain, but in hindsight, if we'd won by say 55% or even 60, given what we now know about the men who are funding Leave, they wouldn't have given up. So all that would happen is we'd have a second and then a third referendum to leave. It would have gone on and on and on. In hindsight, because we weren't going to win with 66% Remain, this is probably better, because this calls the bluff of all those people who say we'd be better off if we could leave. This calls the bluff of everybody who says immigrants are a problem, they use up our housing, they're terrible, everything will be great when they stop coming. You know, this is going to bring it to a head. And it will be painful, but not as painful as 10 or 15 years of continued civil war.
And, I mean, tying into that peak inequality theme, you know, if the city loses its passporting rights, then there'll be fewer bankers arriving, that will create headaches for the Treasury and so on, but it might mean that the pound goes down and other bits of the economy get a bit more competitive, and maybe we could get back into doing some of the things that Britain used to do in the time you're talking about, in the 1970s, when things were more equal.
Oh, when we made more steel in Sheffield than anywhere else on the planet. You can go to Magna and to a museum and see it, you know, in a nice film of it. Well, the bankers, they're already moving the young lawyers and young bankers from Canary Wharf over to Munich and Paris and Amsterdam. That's part of your deal if you now sign on. The banking pay is no longer going up. We had over 2,000 bankers paid over €1 million a year. The next highest country was Germany, 197. That banking pay has stopped, and our bankers will start to move.
Is that good or bad?
That's good. It's good, except this is what we were using to fund our NHS, worse than any other health service in the mainland of Europe. But no, relying on massively overpaid bankers is just a shameful situation to have got into. But we're not going to be manufacturing again. What we can do, and I think we ought to embrace it, is we can do increased tourism. The world's middle class is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And they're all going to want to go on holiday somewhere. And after they've been on holiday to London, some of them can come to Hay, right? And the pound dropping helps with that. My city, my home city of Oxford, we could take many more tourists. And I'd much rather take tourists and take money off tourists than take money from dodgy characters from Russia or arms dealers to build buildings in my home city. And it's a steady income stream of tourists. So I think we should be looking at tourism for the next 10 years as key. Education is the other one, but we have to look at what we're actually selling and whether it really is worth as much as we're telling people they have to pay. Mm. Particularly, you may not know, perhaps I shouldn't say, not patriotic. And if you've got children who are thinking of going to university, they can go to Germany. Do you know how much Germany charges them? Nothing. 330,000 overseas students in Germany. After Brexit, can they go to Germany? Yes. Because Germany takes in students from anywhere around the world. And that isn't just Germany. We don't know about it. It doesn't charge them. We sort of think, how can that happen? The same reason that Germany can spend 40% more on health than we spend. It's just a different way of thinking.
Just on the details of who voted in and out, you did some good myth-busting there, like, you know, the young were in bed, they weren't the real Remainers, etc. You know, it's not necessarily the poorest places that voted out, although that's very much the received commentariat folklore. But another thing people are talking about much more, and as a geography you might have something to say on, is towns versus cities. Mm-hmm. That does seem to be a new divide that's opened up, doesn't it? Not just in the referendum, but in recent...
Or smaller towns. Yeah, it's the places that aren't incredibly successful. I moved 5 years ago, I'd lived for 10 years in Sheffield, and moved to Oxford. And in Sheffield, a third of our shops were shut, boarded up. That was just normal in Sheffield. Mm. And then my biggest shock of moving to Oxford, and I'd grown up there, so it shouldn't have been a shock, was not a single shop was boarded up in Oxford. Not one. And it's the same in the middle of London, whereas you simply go out, and that's what you'll see on the kind of 1970s high streets. The real Remainers were people in areas of the country that had been utterly untouched by things that had gone wrong, or more optimistic, more cosmopolitan people who were used to mixing with other people. The Leavers wanted a future for their grandchildren. The Leavers can remember when, well, my granddad's generation, for any of those, you got $5 to the pound. My mum, she got four. Mine, you got three. I can remember going to France when I was 15 and getting 10 francs to the pound. And you go down and you just see this country falling apart. And you want your grandchildren to have a safe job and be able to get a house and be able to start a family. That's all people wanted. But they were Conservative voters at the bottom of the pile of Conservative voters, and they couldn't see how their own children could get that the way things were going. That's what the picture begins to look like more. And they were told to blame immigrants for this. The reason why your grandchildren can't start a family is the immigrants have taken the houses, the immigrants have got their job. That's what the Daily Mail, which is a classic lower middle class paper, has been telling people for decades. And what do you do if you're told that this is the reason? Well, you do the only logical thing. And you vote to end the problem. Mm. And immigration was by far the biggest influence on the vote. And on previous general elections, they've been the most salient factor in people's decision to vote, because they've been told just how terrible immigrants were. Whereas in fact, the worst thing is if you live in an area where immigrants don't come. If immigrants aren't coming to your area, that's partly why the shops are boarded up, because there aren't enough people wanting to be there.
I mean, on the most chilling thing, I think, in your slides was the stuff on health, inspired by something you wrote before. We got Michael Marmot to write something in the magazine just recently. And, you know, what's going on in Britain is particularly scary, I think, because in America you've now got a very clear drop in life expectancy. Yeah. And you therefore ask the question, yeah, are we going to be next?
We could, if we really, really muck this one up. There's evidence we won't. So currently there's a competition between Labour and the Tories for how to fund the NHS more. And this is wonderful. We're beginning, this is why I say peak inequality. Because that's what you need to start on the road backwards. If some of you might be able to remember when the Conservatives and Labour competed to see who could build the most council houses in the 1950s, maybe just a few of you. And that's perfect. So the Conservatives are playing with the idea of a penny on national insurance, which of course costs the poor more, because, you know, the rich, it's easy to lose a penny on national insurance. Labour are playing with wealth taxes. They'll all get announced in the next few weeks. And there'll be a battle over who can fund the NHS more. Yeah. That's exactly what you want. Because we've got a long, long way to go to get up to average European funding. But it's not, the NHS is only a tiny part of this. It's
It's a very small part of the reason for the life expectancy falling. A much bigger one is adult social care failing. But a bigger one is just Meals on Wheels. Many areas of the country, they've ended. So you're stuck in bed, and unless a relative feeds you, you're not getting that meal. Rural bus services are gone, which you rely on as you get old, because there all comes a point when you can't drive. Half of us will go blind before we die. Half of us. And if you withdraw the welfare state, the people who are most affected are the elderly and frail. The real irony of this big rise in deaths, and the 20,000 this year, is that the people who are dying now, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years earlier than they would have died otherwise, are middle class, because they got through to their late 70s or 80s, and the only middle class people do that. And they will have been middle-aged in 1979, and most of them will have voted for Margaret Thatcher. And the real irony is they're getting the end result of what they selfishly voted for then, but nobody explained to them. If you believe in no such thing as society, but only yourself and your family live 200 miles away because they did ever so well and went to university, and you're on your own in a cottage on the edge of Tewkesbury, and the bus has stopped going, the meal on wheels has stopped going, and adult social services have been cut, so nobody comes for 15 minutes, makes a cup of tea and checks you haven't fallen down the stairs, then you end up dying at 83 rather than 87. And the generation beneath you says, well, times are tough, and we can't afford everything. And if some of the weaker elderly people are dying earlier, it's sad. But, and that's the worst thing about this health story. You try and get the BBC to report it. It's been reported everywhere else. You try and get the BBC to report that infant mortality has risen significantly in the last 2 years. Statistically significant in the last 2 years. Nowhere else in Europe. You've got to go to Texas to find that. And the BBC will not report this because it is almost impossible to find a way to report it and be politically neutral.
Is it... I mean, is it really as... I mean, you're painting an extremely bleak picture.
It's bleak. It's the first time it's happened since the war.
No, this is a terrible statistic, but if you're a Conservative minister, you'd say there's more jobs than there have been at any time before.
Yes.
You'd say...
Yeah, because you have to work because benefits have never been relatively lower, and you get sanctioned if you don't apply for every last job.
You'd
there's
say
more prostitutes than there's been, you know. Look, saying that there's more jobs than ever, it's easy to get people into more jobs than ever. You just make it so truly awful to try and claim benefits.
And they also say inequalities been staying for 25 years, which says
that. Oh, yeah, well, that's really... And the Chancellor said it in the budget. Mm. Well, he's partly right. Inequality... I'll bore you. Because the Chancellor did this in his budget, and nobody complained. Inequality between the median person in the top quintile and the median person in the bottom quintile has fallen since 1990, 25 years. From the median in the top quintile to the median in the bottom. That ignores the top 10% and the bottom 10%. So in the middle society, inequality has fallen since 90. Since about 2012-13, the top 1% has actually begun to go down. The top 10%, that group who the Chancellor was ignoring, by the way, take 28% of all income. They don't feel rich because half of that's taken by the top 1%, you're taking 14. But the top 1% began to go down. So we began to go, but we hadn't become more equal by 2012 or 2013 because the top 0.4% were still taking more. And they were taking more. So everybody was becoming more equal apart from the very rich. Until 2 months ago, when Martin Sorrell was sacked. And then finally, it's like sand falling off the bottom of a cliff. You know, people were becoming more equal in misery at the bottom, but the rich were getting richer and richer and richer until that point.
So, final thing before I'm going to bring the audience in, just in terms of, because along with this kind of social picture of gloom you've got from your side of things, a political picture of hope, which is that you see a big increase in Labour as a vote share in 2017 and a optimistic take on the London elections, but elsewhere in the country it was very mixed. Lots of the country seems very hesitant. The polls are kind of stuck, and Labour maybe just down a bit. If it's a great epochal kind of changing moment, why does politics seem so stuck?
Why is it? Well, it kind of was stuck at the last peak. The last peak, if this is the peak of inequality, it's 1913. It wasn't as things were suddenly wonderful in 1919, 1920, 1921. We had a general strike in 1926. We had a crash. We had a depression. The really bad news about economic peaks of inequality is that the first 20 to 30 years of getting better are not joyous. That's tragic, but that is the way it's been. The only fast route, really fast route, to greater equality is absolute disaster. So Japan in 1946. There has been no successful kind of revolution, but you know, you've got to hold that. It's slow. On the other hand, we're more educated than ever before. Half of all young women go to university, so you know, maybe we could accelerate it a bit, because you're talking about the majority of young women having to live lives of precarity in the future unless we make things better rapidly. It's not the case of needing more money. All of the problems of inequality, insecure jobs, insecure housing, are because of the inequality. The housing's all there. You just need to get rid of so many private landlords. That's what makes you insecure. Private landlords are an absolute curse on people who have to rely on private landlords. But before we can get to dealing with private landlords, you have to win the argument. I'm sure there'll be people in this audience who'll say, I'm a lovely private landlord. And you might feel you are, but your tenants probably don't. And the idea that you can become a landlord is the same as me thinking that I can set up a hospital because I think I know how to do it. And this is, there's a very good future ahead for this country. That's not me being optimistic. When you're the most unequal country in Europe, the only way is improvement. But there's a very good future for the country. But part of winning that future will be winning basic arguments that will appear ever so obvious in a few years' time, but will be hard to win now. A little bit like going back to 1913 and trying to say, it really is not great that we have, back then, a quarter of all income going to the richest 1% families who have these enormous groups of servants. And that isn't good for the country. If you'd argued that in 1913, somebody would just say, well, you're mad. Because they've got such great brains, these leaders, they have to have scullery maids and everybody else around them. You can't possibly have a society in which the great and the good don't have servants. What are you talking about? And we'll have the same kind of arguments today, which in future will appear absolutely ridiculous.
Fantastic. Let's now, I'm just going to have to look like I'm staring at the sun. We're going to take two questions, probably at front. We've got one lady right at the front here, and I think we might have another person straight behind her, which would be convenient for you as well.
Hi. Bit confused. The South Wales Valleys voted very largely Leave. I certainly don't get the impression there are vast quantities of Tory voters there.
No.
And it's one of the most deprived areas of Wales. How does that fit in with your scenario?
Okay, great. And am I right that the person immediately behind you is wanting to ask her? No, we should take one more. Just go. Yep, right there, two thirds of the way back.
Yep. Thank you very much. That was a fascinating talk. I was a bit disappointed when you said we wouldn't be developing manufacturing when we finally sorted out Brexit, if we ever actually do. I feel that manufacturing is the key to getting this country stabilised. The bankers cannot make any money. The only way they make money is taking it off the people who have to borrow it. So if you borrow £1,000, they charge you interest, so the people who borrowed it end up paying back 1,200 quid or whatever it is. And as a result, people at the bottom get poorer and people at the top get richer, which is what you claim.
Okay.
Okay. So manufacturing, I think, is very important.
Okay, thanks for that. So two straightforward questions there.
You're certainly right about the Welsh Valleys, they voted Leave. The correlation with deprivation is 0.03. That means there isn't a correlation. So it's not that the poor voted for Remain. Overall, for the whole of the UK, there is no relationship either way. Wales was actually the nearest to the UK average of any area, country. Wales was most like the UK. So Wales, we're in Wales now, by the way. Wales is the most typical part of the UK. People in the Welsh Valleys who, kind of interesting, you've got to it won't matter, but of course, five generations ago, these were English or Russian. The South Wales Valleys in 1900 were the second highest area of immigration in the world after California, because you couldn't get that many people in that fast. So it's interesting that an area of such high former immigration and no Welsh-speaking voted Leave. But it was targeted for ages, targeted of saying, you need a fundamental change, the elite don't want what you want, and it worked. The other fascinating area in Wales is the area north and south of Aberystwyth University, Gwynedd, and I've forgotten the other county. My geography's not that good in Wales. And it wasn't just a university there. It's quite a high Plaid Cymru vote, quite a solidly Welsh-speaking area, quite cosmopolitan in outlook for other places. So there's a whole set of things being revealed, quite positive about a certain kind of immigration. Not the English retiree immigration, which if you really want an immigration that damages an area, it's people from Birmingham coming and buying the houses locally that you might want to retire into, sending their children to a local school and complaining that their children have to speak the local language in the local school. Those are the really obnoxious immigrants, and they're English. And yet, the part of the country here in Wales that had the most of these really annoying immigrants voted Remain, interestingly. Manufacturing. We ought to be doing our fair share of manufacturing. That is, we ought to be manufacturing enough stuff that we actually consume. The idea we're going to go back to being the work shop of the world, I think, is not going to work. But I certainly think we should try to at least produce what we consume and try and produce in innovative and new ways, and ways which eventually become carbon neutral. But the cliff is so steep that at the moment it's just a case of salvaging things. 1% of all our manufactured goods in the UK come from Oxford. 1% of the entire money we make from manufacturing is from my city. And that's the car factory in Oxford. The car factory is owned by BMW. It produces a Mini every 1 minute, 6 seconds. There are only 3,000 people working at the factory now, rather than 40,000 when I grew up. Half of those 3,000 are English, men largely, who look after the robots. 1,200 robots. They're quite magnificent, these robots. And it's far better having cars made by robots than cars made by people, if you ever saw the factory in the past. But there are 7 lines. The last of the lines, the 7th, is still manual in case the robots go on strike and take control. And the 7th line is manned almost exclusively by Eastern European men. And how they're living in Oxford, affording to live, which shed some of them are living in, is worth asking. Anyway, the point of me telling you this about the protection, this is 1% of our entire manufacturing output, just in this one plant in my city in Oxford. Each of those robots fits inside the back of a lorry. There is a plant on the Austrian border waiting for the robots to be moved to. The components, as you'll guess from the Mini, go back and forth and back and forth across the channel many times. Some of them are made near Birmingham. They go off to Germany, they go to the Netherlands, they come back, they go over again, come back and put in the Minis, which of course go back. That's why we're not going to be charging any tariffs, or we're not going to have a car factory in Oxford or in Sunderland. Yeah, this is the affording thing.
Yeah,
we need a magic money tree to be able to leave in the way that some of the Conservative MPs fantasise about us leaving.
We've got 2 more I can see on that aisle. I can half see.
I have the strong suspicion that over the last 15 years, the yearly claimed increase in numbers of people in the UK economy in work, and both main parties have been actually playing the same argument over 15 years. Each year's increase in total employment is roughly the same as each year's total net immigration figure.
Okay.
Is my suspicion correct?
Okay, we'll take that. Thank you for that. And I think there was another one quite near on the... Yes, a bit back there, yeah.
Yes, if you modified that deprivation graph so that it was white British deprivation, would that have more predictive values?
Yep.
If you look at those very deprived areas that have very high Remain votes on that graph, it's Manchester, Birmingham, quite a few London boroughs, which have large proportions of ethnic minorities who are deprived.
Good question. So both different aspects of immigration, the political and the economic.
The first question, I don't know the answer, but it isn't simply that the people coming, well, you only came if there's a job. Human beings are like billiard balls. They move around the world and they stay where they fit in. So building walls on the Mexican border doesn't stop people coming. People come when there's things for them to come to and stay.
So just arithmetically the case, the employment rate's gone up, hasn't it? So there must be some jobs going to...
Oh no, because there are more people doing two or three jobs now. Tragically, we're becoming more like America. Our students, the majority of our students now have to work. So they're actually doing a part-time job in a bar. In Oxford, it's our primary school teachers. If I go for a pint at 10 o'clock at night, I'm served by a primary school teacher who will be in the classroom the next morning. But hey, we've never had so many jobs. You know, I mean, honestly, how what you want with jobs is a situation where people can choose the job they do, don't have to work for more than 8 hours a day, and don't have to work in jobs they don't want to do. And if you're as old as me, you can just about remember it. You know, that really was the case in the early 1970s. It's possible. This is the case in other parts of the continent to do. But the job balance thing is complicated by people having more than one job. And retired people now working. Because the pension isn't enough. It's not just... It's great people wanting to work, but everybody, well, Homebase is about to go under. But, you know, there's nice people at Homebase who look like they might be taking their pension for 10 years, aren't just there saying, that's where you find the saucer, because they want to. It's because they also want to buy their grandchild a Christmas present. And if they work at Homebase, they can do that. Half our kids in Britain had no holiday last year. No holiday at all. Yeah, that's the kind of country we've become, despite having the highest employment rate ever. So it doesn't add up.
And then on the point about like whether it was the more metropolitan poor...
Sorry, absolutely, you're right. If we... it'd be very hard to do, but because the data doesn't exist, but if we took whether people said they're white British, not white other, I won't do it with you. You're looking very white, by the way, as an audience. But you'll differ. The more Guardian reading want of you will tick on white other. Those who read the Telegraph and the Times will tick white British. The white British poor will, because at the heart of the vote, the strongest thing is a stirred up racism. That's there. We try and pretend it isn't there, but we spent decades telling people that immigrants were a problem. And that had an effect on our population. The other thing worth saying, if you can remember the 1970s, remember skinheads in their 20s? My geography teacher's here. She might not remember when the skinheads came into our school, but they did come in once with their boots and try and beat some of us up. The 20-year-old men in the 1970s and 1980s who were in the National Front, just work out what age group they come to later. Mm. I sometimes think you see them on the back row of Question Time now. Age about 55. Looking a bit redder. And still going, I was right. If we'd only kept them all out, Enoch Powell was right, this country would still be the heart of the empire. And some people's minds you're never going to change.
I think we should just take, we're up against the clock, so we take one more, which I can see just there. Three or four rows back, in the middle. Just give you the mic. And please keep it crisp.
Thank you for comforting us with the idea that we've reached peak inequality. Not having had the chance to read your book yet, could you tell us something about the certainty with which you hold your title?
Okay, about it. It's partly because I can't face writing another book on inequality that I call this one Peak Inequality. But
There have been many examples in the past of when things have got to an extreme like this. And when they do get extremes, when it tends to alter. If it isn't peak inequality, remember, we're more unequal than any other country in Europe, more than Estonia and Lithuania now. So we've got to become more unequal than Turkey. We're already more unequal than Israel, by the way. The divides we pay each other are bigger than the divides, including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. That's how divided a society we are. With only above us is Mexico, Chile, USA, and Singapore. And we could go that way. How stupid are we? You've got to remember, extreme inequality harms 99% of people. You know, are we really going to go with Jacob Rees-Mogg and say, Jacob, we want you and your family to get richer, and you know, I've got some kids, one of them could clean his shoes, don't know what the other one could do. Are we, you know, but back to the past, that's partly why I'm confident about it to peak. It's become so extreme. And also, house prices have been falling now for a year and a half in London, and the centres are down by 10%. That's a wealth reduction. The income inequality, as we said, has cut underneath, and finally at the top, it's gone. The mortality figures are unbelievable. But put it really crudely, there comes a point where there are actually not that many really frail, elderly people left. But when the situation becomes so bad each winter that eventually you have to do something about it. If you like, even the anointment of Theresa May as leader, she was never voted for, by the way, notice, but the anointment of Theresa May as leader shows a reaction against David Cameron and the change. And certainly, Jeremy Corbyn shows that inequality might matter to quite a lot of people, and the biggest political party in Europe might mean something. So I could be wrong. If I am wrong, it's absolutely awful and it's worth emigrating.
Well, but he might be right. Martin Sorrell's gone and yeah. Who knows, he'll go.
Well, Martin's trying to get back. He's actually after a job at the moment, so you can't give it up.
But Dan, thanks so much. I mean, it's been fascinating, even if by turns kind of very encouraging and very scary. Danny's going to be signing his many books, and there's lots to choose from, but at the bookshop, so please do come and buy one, meet him there. And he's also kindly offered to come along to the prospect stand after that, where we'll continue the conversation a bit if some of you had questions that you couldn't get in with. But thanks to all of you for coming along, and huge thanks to Danny.